Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Thursday, October 29th. So the World Series is over now. It ended weird with Justin Turner of the Dodgers being taken out of the game in the eighth inning because of a positive COVID test, but then refusing to stay socially distanced from his teammates despite being told to when they won the World Series and celebrated and had a group photo. Took off his mask in the middle of all that, never mind congregating with them at all. We don't know yet if he infected his buddies. So baseball ends weird after 3 months of otherwise pretty successful modeling of how businesses could handle the virus. But I want to recall for a minute the moment in August when Dominic Smith from the Mets publicly broke down in tears. Because as we all know, COVID hasn't been the only intense thing going on this year in baseball or anywhere else. Here's Dom Smith at a post-game news conference, August 26th, I think the date was, after the police shooting of Jacob Blake in Kenosha, Wisconsin.
I think the most difficult part is to see, like, people still don't care. And for this to just continuously happen, I mean, it just shows just a hate in people's heart. And, I mean, that just sucks, you know? And being a black man in America is not easy. So, I mean, like I said, you know, I wasn't there today, but I'll bounce back. I'll be fine.
Dom Smith of the Mets in tears here 2 days after the end of the World Series. That's certainly one of the moments that I will most remember from this baseball season. That same week, Doc Rivers, coach of the LA Clippers in the NBA, had a similar teary moment. And suddenly those moments were back in the news this week when Jared Kushner criticized them on Fox News Channel on Monday.
You know, you saw a lot of people who were just virtue signaling. They'd go on Instagram and cry, or they would, you know, put a slogan on their jersey or write something on a basketball court. And quite frankly, that was doing more to polarize the country than it was to bring people forward. You solve problems with solutions.
So to Kushner, who presumably is also speaking for the president there, he seems to think Dom Smith and Doc Rivers were just virtue signaling. And here's what else he said. That President Trump wants black people to be successful more than they want to be successful themselves. Listen.
President Trump's policies are the policies that can help people break out of the problems that they're complaining about, but he can't want them to be successful more than they want to be successful.
So black Americans talking about systemic racism are complaining, he used the word complaining, and many don't want to be successful themselves. And one thing that struck me about that is that for all everyone talks about President Trump as an aberration from traditional conservatism, saying racial inequality comes largely from black Americans not striving hard enough is very traditional conservatism for at least the last 50 years. So let's talk about the Trump and Kushner messaging, but talk about it in historical context with WNYC's Kai Wright, host of the podcast The United States of Anxiety and the local call-in show The United States of Anxiety, Sunday nights at 6 here on the station. Hi, Kai. Welcome back to this show.
Hello, Brian.
Did you hear something more new or something more old out of Jared Kushner's mouth there?
I'm going to do my best to keep my composure throughout this, Brian. It's a frustrating moment. You know, it's something very old, and you point out to the last 50 years. I'd go back much further than that. There are two strains of politics that he is speaking to there, both of which come pretty much right after the Civil War, and one is sort of a set of ideas that emerged really within months after black people were emancipated from slavery, that brought together the sort of Confederates, the Southern Confederates and the Northern capitalists on turning the page from Reconstruction. And the other is a strain of thought that we also need to talk about that grew out of the Black community towards the end of the 19th century, a certain kind of striver, don't be a victim politic that still exists very much in the Black community, particularly a particularly kind of Black male politic. And I think it is not coincidental that Jared Kushner is hitting those messages now. We can unpack that history. But in terms of the political message that that campaign is sending right now, one of the two things they're trying to do is peel off Black men and find ways to reunite sort of the profiteering of the North with the project of white supremacy. So we can unpack that history, but that's the long history that these comments come out of.
Well, one of the things that you just said there, it surprised me a little bit that Kushner maybe was actually trying to appeal to some Black voters with that statement rather than him having made a gaffe in terms of saying the quiet part out loud there.
Well, I mean, appeal to a certain no one is arguing that they're trying to win Black voters, and they're certainly not. But we do have to acknowledge that there is a group of Black men in the United States who have supported the Trump campaign. I mean, it's small. It's 1 in 10. I think the latest poll I saw was something like 11% of Black men support him this year, and more. It was a little more than that in 2016. But I pointed out to say that there is a group that this idea of sort of Black self-reliance, it started when Reconstruction ended at the end of the 19th century. There became this idea within the Black community of like, listen, we can't depend on white people to save us. We got to save ourselves, which it was a weird thing to argue since no one was waiting for white people to save us in the first place. Mm-hmm. But that became part of the political conversation in the Black community. And notably, Ida B. Wells, we talk about her as a journalist, but one mm-hmm. of her great contributions to history was to say, that's ridiculous. We have to fight for our rights as well as protect ourselves. And over the course of the 20th century, a certain group of Black men started to really embrace that sort of don't be a victim, Black self-reliance thing. And you know, and it comes, you know, following the civil rights movement, and then again in the 80s and 90s. And I say all of that to say that I think it's notable that Kushner is saying these things at a time when you have the Ice Cubes and the Kanye Wests, some of these celebrity Black men, millionaires rather, mm-hmm. Who have started to get in their camp. That macho self-reliance, don't be crying, that is something that speaks to a certain part of the Black male politic that we need to be talking about in our community.
It's interesting because you're thinking of it in terms of Ice Cube and Kanye West. I'm thinking of it in terms of Ronald Reagan and Newt Gingrich.
Well, both things are true, right? You know, I mean, so that's what I mean about there's two strains. So there's that strain. But then there's also, you know, I mean, so this is what I meant about at the end of the Civil War. I'll go all the way back to that. Within a year after emancipation, there became this argument to say, hey, listen, you know, enough already with all of these, quote, special rights. That special rights idea, that started within a year after the Civil War. Mm. Enough with all these special efforts to help Black people. They need to help themselves. We've freed them from slavery. They have to abandon this idea of being victims and stand up on their own two feet. And that idea is what unified the Confederates, the former Confederates, and the Northern capitalists who wanted to bring an end to Reconstruction. This was the unifying idea. It was like, okay, slavery's over. Now they need to help themselves. Don't be victims. And that idea has remained in our politic ever since then. And it's just important to remember how deep that runs. And it's notable for the Trump campaign because, and I bet it's come up in every election since then, but it's notable for the Trump campaign because that's part of the coalition they have to put back together in order to have a majority.
And I know they've said they're trying to get, or a lot of analysts have said, they're trying to get just a few more percentage points of Black male voters as part of what they hope will be the winning coalition in 2020. a lot of people don't realize there was a bit of a gender gap in Black American voters in 2016, where they got close to zero Black women, but, you know, maybe like a little over 10% of Black men, right?
Yeah. And it's also part of their voter suppression effort, right? Like, if they can convince enough Black people to just throw up their hands and not vote. And also, I mean, we have to say, like, we talk about all these things in terms of sort of the political strategy, but it's also the things they believe, you know? And I think Jared Kushner believes this and has, you know, been spending time, presumably, with some of these Black conservatives who also believe this. And they are uniquely male. They are wealthy. And they are macho. And so they hear that clip of sports, you know, of somebody crying, and they see weakness in that. And I think it's important to point out on all sides of this, whether you're talking about sort of the white people who have believed in Black victimhood as a problem, are these Black men who seem to want to sort of politic around Black victimhood as a problem. The tell that there's something else afoot here is how easily both of those groups of people are triggered by Black power, right? So shortly after this idea was introduced into our political lexicon, the idea that Black people need to take care of themselves, shortly after that, when Black people did, in fact, start taking care of themselves. So, you know, despite all this, freed slaves did, in fact, rise up and start excelling at all kinds of things in business and politics and education. And was a reign of violence.
That led to Jim Crow.
And violence, murder, murderous violence, decades of murderous violence in explicit response to the effort to take care of themselves, you know. And I think it's also a tell with some of these more conservative Black men, some of these Black men like that, you know, that have risen to this idea that that too many Black people think of themselves as victims. When you see Black women step into their power, they also respond quite often with a degree of violence and rage when they see a hierarchy being challenged. And so that is to the tell to this rhetoric, is that the same people who want to fetishize Black victimhood often become freak out when Black people start owning our power.
Desmond in Crown Heights, you're on WNYC. Hey, Desmond.
Good afternoon. Good morning, Brian, and thank you for taking my call. I'm so happy that you're finally dealing with this subject, but I find that the media, especially following talking about the top media heads from the internet world, the media is always dealing with the symptom and never the problem. The problem is that we have a millennia of dehumanization of people of color, followed by this country being founded, in the words of Benjamin Franklin, we have a republic if we can keep it. A republic speaks to a hierarchical structure, but this country claims that it's a democracy. The immediate hierarchy of this country was 7% of landed white males. This country perfected the science of advertising, which is just another name for brainwashing. It has set white supremacy and the culture of white supremacy all over the world. And at the root of that is the fact that this country was also founded on the basis of human trafficking, which people like to write off as slavery. That goes back to the millennial statement. You've had Ibram X. Kendi on here, who wrote about the history of the dehumanization of people of color from Africa. And as recently, I just saw this the other day in the Atlantic, but I found out that a family member had gone to a seminar about anti-racism, going back to August 24th of 1957, when William F. Buckley, the leading conservative, debated James Baldwin. And Buckley basically said that white people were right if they used everything up to and including violence to subjugate people of color, should they ever gain numerical advantage. People have blamed people of color for being fecund, meaning to be able to procreate a lot. But it's amazing that we never got past 12, 13, 14% of the population of this country. That seems to be a major attriting factor. I mean, a wearing down or stopping of the growth of our population.
Desmond, I'm going to leave it there. You put a lot on the table. I want to have some time for some other callers. And there were a number of different strands in there. Kai, is there anything you wanted to enter on?
Well, I mean, I guess I would agree with much of what Desmond was trying to say, that, you know, much of our politics has been and remains rooted in the dehumanization of black people, which is why Black Lives Matter as a slogan is somehow still a radical statement in 2020. So it's the case that, you know, this particular formation of that, you know, black people want to be oppressed, right? Like that we want to be victims, in Jared Kushner's framing, that idea has been part of the dehumanization of black people since at least a few months after emancipation from slavery.
Desmond, thank you for your call. Keep calling us. Steve, and I would have to go, one thing on that, I would have to go back and listen to the Baldwin-Buckley debate again to see if Buckley put anything quite in those threatening terms the way Desmond framed it. Did you have any recollection of that?
I won't try to quote it off the top of my head. but yes, I would urge everybody should go look at those debates anyway, because they're really
amazing.
Cool.
Amazing. Steve in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with Kai Wright. Hi, Steve.
Oh, Brian, how you doing, brother? It's always great to speak to you, good sir. You're a treasure, national treasure, and I truly appreciate you do just all you do for the city.
Thank you.
And actually the country just in general. And what's up, brother Kai? How you doing?
Hello.
I just say all this to say I'm a millennial, I'm a progressive, I'm college educated, I'm a Democrat. It's like I voted for Bernie Sanders. Reluctantly, I voted for Hillary Clinton, you know, the last election. I supported Barack Obama two terms. So, like, I'm just putting that out there. And I voted for Cynthia Nixon, I guess Andrew Cuomo. So, like, I'm a progressive out here. And to be frank, if I was going to vote for Joe Biden this turnaround, I would vote, like, on a working family's line. So I'm just putting that out there. But I also just wanted to say, like, I'm part of the 10% this time. And it's because, like, again, I know for sure that with Jared Kushner, he's kicking. And what he's saying is hogwash, literally hogwash. Like I said, I went to Morehouse College. I'm college educated. I don't believe, like, African-Americans don't want to be successful and all that. No, it's literally systemic racism. And it's at the root of this, I guess, a bunch of issues in the country. The issues that I have is that the Democratic Party, just in general, has just taken African-Americans' vote for granted for, like, years, and specifically the black male vote as well. And I also just felt, too, with Joe Biden, through his history, from the policies to the crime bill to the gas, so even when he was running against Barack Obama, saying, I guess he speaks nice and he's clean and all of that, to Kamala Harris, trying to play the sister girl role, but she wasn't really playing African-American in Howard, and her whole record as Attorney General, and even if we want to be celebrating black girl magic, and sister girl magic, which I'm all about, her track record even over at the Attorney General's office and, like, the Willie Brown situation, it's highly questionable. So, again, too.
So, Steve, let me jump in and ask you a question.
The black... Oh, just real quick, can I just give 5 more seconds?
Sure.
And say the black community, again, when I'm looking at her as well, and I don't even see a black family there. There's no black kids, there's no family, no black husband. So, again, don't try to rally the community when she herself is not steeped in the community. But go ahead, Brian.
So I just am curious, when you point out all those various shortcomings of Biden and Harris from their histories, and you say that this time you're going to be one of the 10%. By that, do you mean you're going to vote for Trump?
Oh, yeah, for sure. And, like, to be frank, I'm here in New York, so I know, like, it's a blue state, so I'm really not going to go far. More of a protest vote. Initially, I was going to just write in...
Whoops. I think we lost Steve Lawrence for a second. Wait, Steve, you there? Sorry, who did you say? You clicked off there for a second. Who did you say you might were thinking of? Right? No, I think it was on our end. Who were you going to write in?
I said initially I planned in to write in Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, but I'm here in New York and I really wanted to make a specific point. Like, I'm not just going to do Joe Biden and just stand at the DNC. I'm truly tired of the games and I'm just tired of being taken for granted. And to be frank as well, like, again, too, like, I understand, like, this Republican party over here, there's a bunch of racism over there. I know in the DNC as well, though, there's a bunch of racists over there, too. And they just know how to turn it on or off. And it's conversations that we have in small group conversations and the conversations we have for the media. So, again, like, it's two sides of the coin. And I hear people. I understand systematic racism as well. But, like, too, as well, with immigration, this issue as well, I don't think anybody speaks how, like, it affects the ADOS community. Like, people who are here, who are African-Americans, and they can't get, like, you know, I guess, decent jobs as American wages. And, like,
ADOS, American Descendants of Slaves. Steve, I'm going to leave it there for time, but thank you for the call, and do keep calling us. And, Kai, again, a lot of places we could enter that, but one thing that strikes me is the frustration that, you know, even if people are shaking their heads that, oh, he's going to vote for Donald Trump, what? He said he's going to do it in the context of New York, where it's a safe blue state, presumably. And I'm sure that you also heard the frustration that there aren't two serious parties competing for black votes.
I mean, sure, that is the case, that there is, for a lot of people, black, white, purple, green, there's just the nature of our winner-take-all political system does not offer a lot of space for people's range of views. But I will also say that what is clear is that in terms of this attitude about voting for Donald Trump versus voting among black people versus voting for Joe Biden, this is a gendered thing. Now, we can debate why and how, but just from a data factual point of view, this is a gendered issue. That you do not hear this amongst black women. Mm. You only hear this amongst, in a small percentage, but, you know, 10% is not a nothing percentage of black men. So there is a gendered issue at play here that we have not spent enough time thinking about. And I just want to also throw in whatever else is true about Steve's politics and everybody else's, the comment about Kamala Harris, we can't just let pass. There's no reason to be questioning Kamala Harris's racial identity in relationship to the black community. She went to a black college. She was in a black sorority. She leads what she believes to be a black life, and that is a black life and a beautiful life. And so nobody should be out here asking whether or not she's black enough.
Sharon in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Sharon.
Hi, good morning, Brian. Thank you so much for allowing to hear this conversation. It really struck a nerve. I am a educator. I've worked in New York City public school system. I'm also a professor. This whole conversation about Kitchener and his whole comment, I just throw that out. And I just want to consider for a minute the supports that black community has had. We have black colleges, we have black churches that have been the institutions where we couldn't go anyplace else to be vilified, to be even heard. These were the spaces where black people could gather and to put their heads together around what it is they needed to do in their community. So we've always been connected to community. And I say this because I worked in Harlem and lived in Harlem, and a lot of our children that came to us were children that were from struggling families. But we, as a school community, we provided that haven, that safe space for them to really excel academically, but also socially and emotionally. And I'm just appalled by it. And I understand my black brothers. I understand they have their issues. But to say that out and out right that black folks don't know what they're doing and they've never been in charge, it's a lie. You have to know your history, not only Reconstruction, but even all the black businesses that have come through here. You talk about Ebony, you talk about Essence Magazine, all these publications that have been started for black folks to educate black folks about their image. And I just think that it we got to look at all sides of it. No, this present administration is not for black people. As contrary to, I live in New York, Donald Trump, we know him as a landlord who does not favor black folks at all or any people of color. But I really just want to say that, you know, we are not, you know, we're not waiting for a handout. Folks have, you know, you talk about the expression, pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Well, some folks didn't have straps in their boots. And so what we're basically saying right now, even in 2020, the same thing we've said from Reconstruction period and even forward and whatnot, is that black folks are doing this themselves. It may not be talked about a lot. It may not be celebrated a lot. But we as a people need to understand and embrace that. I have 3-5 young people now that are starting digital businesses in the black community. And these are black entrepreneurs. They're doing this stuff now. It's not talked about. All right, it's not celebrated, but folks realize, you know, we know that we have to do this for ourselves, and we have children and grandchildren who we're training to go into these places and these spaces and to use their intelligence and not be sold this bill of goods that, you know, only black celebrities are the ones that are doing it. And this whole image worship of celebrities, that's a whole other thing. That's brainwashing, too, because I have young people that felt that because they didn't have the money or they weren't in the spaces where all these black entertainers were, that they couldn't do what they needed to do. And we had to refute that. And we basically had to reorganize their thinking and have them think critically about where they wanted to go and how they wanted to get there. So I'm just so glad to be here to just give that point of view. But, it's not over. It's not over for black folks. Not even the least. We just ain't talking about it. We're not letting people peep into it, because when folks get into it, and we know even among ourselves, we have different ideologies, and they clash, we understand that. We understand that very well. But we are still moving forward, regardless whether or not for other folks go with us. We're going to move this thing forward. And black lives do matter.
Sharon, thank you so much. Appropriate last words for this segment. From Sharon in Manhattan. Last words except, Kai, I'm sure you're going to have a great and maybe intense, I don't know, United States of Anxiety on Sunday night, 2 days before Election Day. And listeners, for those of you who don't know, besides this show on the weekdays, there is now Kai's local call-in show, The United States of Anxiety on WNYC, Sunday nights in the 6 o'clock hour, right after All Things Considered. What do you have on tap for this Sunday? I can only imagine what you're choosing from.
We're actually going to be imagining, we're going to open our minds for a radical imagination of a black future. So it's an appropriate segue from this segment.
Kai, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.